perused the bruised throat, you droping owners. Welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. If this is your first podcast, maybe go back and listen to an earlier episode. I have a wonderful treat for you this week. Returning to the podcast is the magnificent Mancon Magan. He's a documentary maker, he's a writer, he's a folklorist, he's an etymologist of the Irish language, and he's someone I just adore speaking to. I love speaking to Mancon because we're both curious about the exact same things, and I love checking in with Mancon every 6 months or every year and finding out what he's been up to and what adventures he's been on. And I always come away learning something new. And also, Mancon is someone I check in with when I'm reading about Irish mythology or Irish folklore. And I check in with him because of his understanding of the Irish language. I don't speak the Irish language, unfortunately. Had a bit of a shitty time in school when I should have been learning it. And I just haven't found the time as an adult to relearn the Irish language. So Mancon does speak the Irish language fluently. And because of this, he has an understanding of Irish mythology and Irish folklore that goes far beyond what I can grasp by simply reading English translations. He goes right back to the words and what they mean and the roots of words. So we had a free-form conversation. We had a conversation about Irish mythology, folklore, the relationship and importance of Irish mythology with the ecosystem, with the environment, with forests. And also, Mancon recently spent time in Australia, where he was welcomed by Aboriginal Australian people so that they could exchange knowledge between Irish folklore and Aboriginal folklore and to find the commonalities between the two. Mancon has a new book coming out in September, which is called Wolfmen and Waterhounds, and it's about the myths, monsters and magic of Ireland. I think it's directed at younger readers, but check out any of Mancon's books, like 32 Words for Field or Banshees, Fingers and Other Irish Words for Nature, and his podcast, The Almanac of Ireland. Check out anything Mancon is doing because he's a very fascinating person who's incredibly passionate about what he does. So let's go straight into the chat. So Mancon, thank you so much for coming back onto the podcast. I don't even really have a plan for today. I think this is your fourth time or something being on the podcast, and I just like ringing you up whenever and just finding out what the fuck you're up to.
We've had such a great chats, but each chat we've had has made me think about things differently afterwards. So,
oh, fantastic.
I get enriched.
The first thing I want to ask you about is you do have a new book coming out, right? Is it September, is it?
Exactly, yeah, towards the end of September. Yeah, it's like a picture book, an illustrated book.
Yeah, because I just had a quick look at, you sent me a look in advance, and it looks really interesting. You're having a crack at mythology this time, Irish mythology.
Yeah, exactly. So if the first book I was doing, I was looking at all the insights that are in the Irish language. And then I did sort of a children's book of that called Tree Dogs and Banshee Fingers, looking at the particular nature words and how nature words in Irish make us see things in a different way, just because of the way our ancestors used to look at nature. They looked at it almost like a child. So like a duanala, is a spider. Mm-hmm. And duanala means it locks of the wall. So they were obviously just staring at things and thinking, this is what reminds me of it. Or like how a grannog is a hedgehog. So grannog, it could mean like little ugly things. So they just thought this, it was just this little child.
Ugly is grann, isn't it? Or
exactly. Groin is groin, and then grann is ugly. Yeah.
Do you know what I find interesting there about hedgehog in particular, right?
Go on.
Hedgehogs were brought here by the Normans.
Huh.
Yeah, we didn't have hedgehogs. They were brought here by the Normans in the 11th century because they used to eat them. They used to eat hedgehogs. So I find that interesting, that because to call it a little ugly thing, there's a little hint of contempt there.
Yeah.
Spiders are ugly too, but a spider's been there all the time. It's this thing on the wall. There's respect. But now you have this new little animal that's part of an invading army. And now all of a sudden it's an ugly little thing. And I like that. I like what that reveals about this is a colonizer's animal.
That's beautiful. That is gorgeous. Yeah, I never thought about that. Huh. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so, it makes sense. It does.
And I just love the way that we drop all these hints and codes into our past, into words. And we don't even know. We use the word every day. We don't think actually someone was trying to communicate something about a concept or about something that was important to them. They just dropped it into the word.
Is that very unique for the Irish language?
I don't think so. I think languages do that. I think people, I mean, humanity, all they're trying to do is amass the sort of the group wisdom of their people and then bring it forward. And they do it in every way. I think they put it into landscape, they put it into words, they put it into story. But after I'd looked at language, I thought, okay, well, actually, there's even more knowledge in the landscape. So that was the last book I think we were talking about was Listen to the Land Speak, mm-hmm. looking at the knowledge that's in the landscape. But then I wanted to do sort of an illustrated kids' view of that book, version of that. And I decided I was going to look at the portals and thresholds in the landscape, because that's the one thing that is so clear in Ireland. There are these, there's so many ways of getting to the underworld or the other world everywhere, mm-hmm. whether it's through rivers or ring forts or just caves or caverns or even just time warps in the landscape. And so I just collected maybe about 18 or 20 of these around Ireland and put them in this illustrated book, which calls Witch, Wolfmen and Water Dogs. And what's weird is I've just listed 18 of them, okay? And I can probably guarantee there's nobody in Ireland who's been to all 18 of those places.
No.
Genuine. I mean,
because I saw with the book, you went county by county. So is it correct to say with the book, so you've gone county by county and what you're searching for are mythological sites that have a connection with the other world?
Exactly, yeah.
Wow,
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, places that our ancestors said either spirits came through or humans could pass back to the other world. And in fact, they're everywhere. They're every single parish. It's so hard to pin them down. But as you said, I decided to do a sunwise journey around Ireland, going to some of these key sites.
And how many of these sites then became Christian sites?
Probably about 60-80% of these. Like, it's weird. But, every well was, as we talked about in the previous podcast, was an entranceway to another world. And probably 95% of those were Christianized. St. Mm-hmm. Patrick purposely went and Christianized them. So it does make sense. Like, if these are the areas that are sort of our pagan ancestors worshipped and knew they could access, then obviously the church is going to come in and say, oh, no, Jesus and the Virgin Mary can come through those places too.
Because something I've been thinking about a lot recently, whenever I my interest in mythology is always from a climate perspective. I always look at mythology as a product of the human animal. And I think that mythology exists in humans to keep us in line with systems of biodiversity. That's what I think the nature's intention for mythology is. You have these humans here, and they have language, and they create this mythology about the environment, because ultimately what it does is it keeps us in a regenerative, respectful way with the environment. It makes it something to be feared rather than to be exploited. You get me?
Yeah, totally.
And something about, I think Christianity was real bad for the environment. And I tell you, this is just a little hot take I'm working on, but the early church, right? I'm talking first, second century. Christian church, they really didn't like demons. The demons were a big part of early Christianity. Demons as in angels that had fallen from hell.
Yeah.
And all throughout Christendom, so all of Europe, all of the Middle East, as Christianity spread, obviously what Christianity was coming up against was paganism. And pagan sites tended to be very much about nature, connected with an outdoor site. And in the early church, consecration became a thing, creating an indoor building so that you could bless this and protect it from demons. And the church, wherever it went, would see something like a holy well or a holy tree, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in Ireland, anywhere around Europe. And they said, no, that's wrong. This outdoor nature shit, That's where demons have freedom. We need to build a little church, consecrate it, bless it. And the only thing demons are afraid of is Christ, the blessing of Christ. And I see that as a moment where humanity demonized nature effectively and fetishized buildings.
Lovely, lovely. Yeah. But even, you know, do you remember that according to Pliny and Caesar and all, they said that the place that our ancestors worshipped, in other words, the Druids of the Celtic people were in these nemata, which is like a sacred grove or clearing, in mainly in an oak wood. But it could also
when
be
you mentioned Pliny there now, are you talking about Pliny speaking about Ireland?
Yeah, Pliny the Elder, yeah. Exactly. The historian and geographer who would have written about Ireland in, the second century.
Did his dad write the world's first encyclopedia? No, Pliny the Elder is the older fella, so he wrote the world's first encyclopedia, didn't
That's
he?
That's right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, Pliny the Younger wasn't as great a scholar as him.
Yeah.
But he was just so curious about the world. And, you know, he included places in Ireland that were important. So back then, there was some sites in Ireland that they thought were important enough. That one, Grianon and Alloch, Grianon's fort up outside Derry.
So it made it as far as Rome. They knew about this in Rome.
Exactly. And then, you know, and Ptolemy was the other great mapper of the world, and he was from Alexandria in Egypt. So when you're talking about Rome, you're talking as much about Northern Africa too, because, you know, the Mediterranean was a small pond they were going across.
So Pliny was born AD 23. So Pliny was born 23 years after the birth of Christ. So within his lifetime, he was interested in Ireland and knew about Ireland as a pagan place.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly they were interested in those Celtic groups of Northern Europe, and they were the same, like the ones that were in Britain, in Ireland, and Northern France. They seemed to have the same practices. And he was the one who was saying that they worshipped in these oak groves. Well, he didn't actually mention oak, but it was groves in big woodlands, and it's considered to be oak. And so, you know, then we come to take a leap 1,000 years and you see those big Gothic cathedrals. And what are they but basically stone manifestations of oak forests? Yeah. You know, these huge trunks and the branches coming up in the middle and meeting in the center. So it's always
I never thought of it that way. I always saw churches as more of a cave thing. But now that you explain it with the huge big pillars in the middle, it is quite foresty.
Yeah, so probably it started with recreating a cave and then. But maybe it was like within their DNA. They weren't even aware that their ancestors 2,000 years ago had sought these groves in big forests to do their ceremonial rituals. And then they just, you know, they instinctively recreated them. But then the other amazing thing is the early church in Ireland, it's all about oak trees. So, you know, obviously St. Patrick is the main man, but then Cullum Killa in Derry. Where is he? He's in Dira, mm-hmm. which means oak tree. And even like Cullum Quilla, his name, Cullum the dove of the quill of the woodland.
Okay.
The dove of the woodland. And then Bridget, where is she? She's in Kildare, the church. That's, you know, Kill and Quill are different. Quill can be a church and it can be a woodland. But they're Kildare, the church in the oak woodland. And then the centre of Cullum Quilla in the south was in Duro. And what does Duro mean? Dara Vog. It means the plain of the oak tree. So all of these early Christian sites are still trying to say, actually, these are sites connected to an oak clearing or an oak cathedral, an oak spiritual centre in the forest.
So when we're speaking about early Irish Christianity there, we're talking in the region of 1,500 years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
And
yeah.
Something I'd love to ask you about, and this is even, are you familiar with the writer Liam O'Flaherty?
I am, yeah.
So, like, I was reading a lot of Liam O'Flaherty recently. Now, he's not that long ago. Liam O'Flaherty was writing in about 1920 onwards. And Liam O'Flaherty was from the Aran Islands, and he wrote a hell of a lot about nature. And something that broke my heart when I was reading Liam O'Flaherty's stories was when he spoke about how many animals that he would see in his environment, it felt like he was lying. He would talk about looking at a lake in, you know, 1920 and this lake bubbling with fish on the surface. And me as someone in 2023, I was like, you're talking out of your arse, man. You're exaggerating. And that made me feel really sad because I don't think he was lying. I think there actually were that many animals 100 years ago that this was the reality he was writing about. And when you speak there about the early Irish church, and all the woodlands I mean, do you get a sense when you read this stuff from 1500 years ago that we're talking about an Ireland that looked differently because we had more forests?
Yeah, without doubt. Like, I mean, you know, as you looked at woodlands in the podcast before, how there were periods where we had more and then less and then more and less.
We're a rainforest. We're supposed to be a rainforest. That's what Ireland is supposed to be.
And that's only an insight that we've only got really in the last 10 years. It's been amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The work about realizing this temporal Atlantic rainforest and the work that Home Tree is doing to regenerate it and Dalton and Vera. They say that actually 100 years ago was almost the lowest point of our woodland because, you know, since then we have from the 1920s on, Arthur Griffith and Sinn Féin were really determined to replant the island. But there were still places, there wasn't obviously big woodlands, but there were still those river valleys that had kept, some of the old growth alive.
Because it was difficult to extract the trees.
Exactly.
I was up in San Francisco and I was in a beautiful redwood forest up in the mountains. And they said straight up, the only reason this redwood forest exists is it was too awkward to take the wood out.
That's it, exactly. So it's called, in Canada and the States, they're called the watersheds, protect the watersheds. And it's the same. So I'm involved in this charity Home Tree in County Clare. We've just bought like 270 acres of the Maugham Valley in Galway. And it looks in Connemara, just to rewild. But because you can't say reforest, because you can't come in. So we have the biggest organic native tree nursery in Ireland.
I didn't know about this, Mancon. Tell me about this. So it's called Home Tree. Where do you get your funding? How do you get money to buy a lot of land?
We started up in Enniskillen in County Clare, and we started really small. We just gathered whatever trees we could, whatever money we had to buy a few patches in County Clare. And then just people got behind us and some organizations did. And now we're just putting out the call for I mean, it's kind of hard because every time you buy a woodland, it's going to cost thousands. Like, this one, probably 750 grand. We have that. Then we're looking at another land. In fact, you saw this week, there's been a lot of talk about
the Connor Pass.
Yeah.
10 million.
Yeah, exactly. 1,500 acres. But so we're always looking, how do we find these? In fact, in some ways, there is money there, but it's to try and find, you can get money from benefactors, which have no strings attached. Then there's corporate clients who are offering us money, but then you have to look at greenwashing. Then there's the government, the government has been really helpful to us and really supportive of us. They can't be giving us money immediately.
Here's a question there regarding the greenwashing, because why the fuck would a corporation want to give Mancon a lot of money to build a forest and they can't make money off it? I'm assuming there is that certain corporations, they could make a donation like this and then that goes against their carbon footprint or something.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, you see, what they would love is that they would give us money to buy the land and we'd say they were sequestering a certain amount of carbon. Now, Home Tree, this organization, does not do that. We don't go anywhere near carbon just because you can't make claims like that. You can't make promises. There's going to be really good credits come along stream. Like, so at the moment, carbon credits, that idea is too simple. It's probably been thrown out the window. But now the next thing they're moving on to is biodiversity credits, where it's not just, you're managing to keep carbon, but how much biodiversity are you keeping? But the next step again is social and biodiversity credits. So what social impact are you doing by planting this woodland or rejuvenating this woodland?
And how do you measure that?
Like in some parts of the world, mangrove woodland, a mangrove forest along a coastline will protect all of the people on the coastline from sudden storms. So you have a guaranteed social benefit to those people. In Colombia, at the same time, if you stop, even in Ireland, if you plant woodlands that are stopping floods, that are going to stop cities becoming flooded, that's a definite social benefit. But it's all really complex and it's going to take computers and it's going to take think tanks and groups to come together with a really good way of pricing the benefit of woodland. So for the moment, we don't. If a corporation comes to us, we say, we're not going to give you any guaranteed biodiversity, prize or value on the land. But you're welcome to tell clients that you're supporting this woodland. But what I was going to say, let's say with these 270 acres in Connemara that we've just bought, like it's stripped. It's absolutely bare, shorn upland that had too much sheep on it for too long. So we're going in there.
Okay, so we're talking Connemara, because I'm thinking with Connemara, I view Connemara as quite barren. That's what comes to me when I think of Connemara. I do think of barren, but also I'm aware a lot of that barrenness is because sheep, which are not wild, they're domesticated, have just eaten everything. So you're left with a strange little desert.
Exactly, exactly. And we might say now, okay, we don't have as many sheep on the woodland, on the uplands as we did. And that's fair. But the fact is the uplands are in such weak condition now that it doesn't take many sheep to go in and just strip any little sapling that's going to grow. So, you know, it's just the system is so weak that it's hard. So as I said, when we buy this land, we want to restore it. That does not mean going buying a load of, you know, oak saplings, bringing them in from Europe of risky provenance. We want to get those oaks and the, you know, whatever, the alder and the rowan, whatever we're going to plant up there, from really old growth trees in Ireland. We're going out collecting the seeds ourselves, have this organic native seed nursery. But even that, ideally, you're not doing that. Ideally, you're just going to the watersheds. And so if we walk this whole...
Going to the watersheds, what does that mean?
So we walk the 270 acres. It all looks barren, but there are these places at the creeks or at the streams.
Oh, wow.
Or in the cleft of a rock, you'll find one little willow bush or a hawthorn bush or one alder or a mountain ash that has managed to survive. And then...
Oh my God, that's beautiful and very depressing at the same time.
Yeah, but it happens really quickly because beneath that soil will be the original mycelium of the ancient woodland that was there. So all you need to do is keep some grazers away from that, and all those spores and seeds are ready to take over again. And it can happen very quickly. And within 10 years, you'd be amazed by the impact it can have.
So, I'd love for you to speak a little bit about that there, Mancon, because that's really interesting what you said there, and people might not know about it. So what you said there, so you're looking for watersheds. So you're going to go around this barren area in Connemara and you're going to search and go, there's a spot there that nobody has fucked with and there's a few native trees. But what you also mentioned there was you're interested not only in the tree, but the fungal network underneath that tree, the network of mycelium and mushrooms. Can you tell us about that and why that's important?
Yeah, because I suppose we are beginning to realize the beauty about science now. Science for, you know, 300 years has been absolutely saying, just look at what you can look under the microscope. That is the only thing. Mm-hmm. In other words, atomize everything, break everything into categories. And only in the last 20 years, it seems every single scientific field is realizing the unified theory. It's only about when everything is part. It's how a whole system, a biodiverse system, is connected to everything. So we look at a tree and we think a tree is important. But let's say those redwoods in South America, in San Francisco. What's just as important is the incredible root systems and mycelium systems that are giving and that are underneath the soil, and this vast array of bacteria and interconnected species that are feeding the soil and that are feeding the mycelium, which are this fungal network, which are then in turn feeding the roots that are then feeding the trees.
And just to simplify this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just thinking of listeners. Mm-hmm. Trees basically have their own internet. Or if you don't want to use the word internet, for me, what I view the mycelium structure underneath a forest, that's how... It's the social network of a forest. Communication happens amongst these plants and trees regarding resources, chemicals, nutrients, predators. A forest does communicate with itself and all the things in that forest, and this is what the mycelium does. Does that sound right?
Exactly, that's right. So there was a beautiful book called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Velleben, which cast a clear eye on this. Some way we've gone a little bit too far in this. So scientists, again, in the last 10 years have realized some of these concepts, like that there was a mother tree, and a mother tree could decide what nutrients and sort of healing properties she could give out to other trees in the woodland, and she could pick which trees she could give and not to others. So basically the trees were working, as you say, in this idea of the worldwide web of all of them feeding each other. Now, some of those claims have been disproven a little in the last 5 years. So realizing, okay, not that they're not true, but we just don't have the proof to realize exactly how much each tree is communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. But definitely we're realizing that actually there is a lot more going on, both mainly through the root system, because the roots then are connected to the mycelium, and the mycelium is a totally different thing. It's the network of funguses. It's when you, you know, lift up an old stone or dig in the soil, and you might see all these little white strands of mushroomy mm-hmm. type strands, and they're bringing sugars from different plants, but they're also seeming to communicate knowledge about a pest that'll be in one tree. Mm-hmm. And maybe probably encoding that into a chemical, into a sweet or a sour or some chemical that the other trees read. It's all like it's a new field, and some of the more popularized books have taken leaps that haven't really been supported by science. But what we do know is that, yeah, there's a lot more going on. And so a tree is not just a tree. It's a whole family under the ground, above, communication with everything. And if we want healthy woodlands, we need to support that whole, allow that whole complex interrelation continue. And for that, the old days, had I been involved in the tree charity 20 years ago, you would have just planted a tree in the soil and left it.
Yes. And what I find fascinating about all this, Mancon, is it also ties in with your work around mythology. It ties in with your work around folklore. You just said there, you know, speaking about the mycelium structure in a soil and how communication happens within an ecosystem under the soil between plants. And you said there, this is all new. And it's like, in a way it is, but also it's not. It's deeply pagan. And one of the things, Western rationalism, and like which I would include Christianity with, the type of Western rational thinking, real evidence-based empirical thinking, which you would have accumulated with the Enlightenment, where we get modern science, which obviously is amazing and it's incredible and brilliant. Also, too, it excludes stuff that sounds a bit bonkers. What you're talking about there regarding the, you know, trees can communicate with an underground fungal network. That sounds mad. That sounds airy-fairy. That sounds like something you immediately want to rubbish. It sounds like it's not evidence-based. And now we're finding out, science is going, actually, I think this might be true. And I reckon long, long ago, they kind of knew this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just think of the word druid. For druid, druid means druvid. Dru is the oak tree, or it also means the center axis, the center spine. And vid is knowledge of wisdom. So it's the oak tree, or the central spine, or axis, or axis mundi, which could access wisdom. And so mm-hmm. that's basically, it's the same concept as the spine in yoga. The oak tree and the spine are the same, and the axis mundi. The axis mundi means the axis of the world, you know, the center point to which everything connects. And the reason that was considered to be an oak tree or a sacred magic tree, because mm-hmm. the oak tree has its trunk in this world, its roots in the other world, and then its leaves branching up into the heavens, into the celestial orb. And you can either call that the spiritual heaven or just the sun. It was like an understanding of photosynthesis. It was an understanding that our energy came from the sun, the whole energy of the universe, of this, at least, yeah, of this particular solar system comes from the sun. It feeds into the trunk, it feeds into all of us, and then it goes down into Earth, and then the Earth brings up its mycelium, its wisdom from the center. So this center, the concept of a druid, the concept of yoga, the spine in yoga, which, you know, it's the same idea. They come from the same root. Druid is as much a Sanskrit word as an early Irish word, are all connected. Everything was about the tree. And you remember in Ireland, the center point, talking of my book about portals and thresholds, the mm-hmm. center threshold in Ireland is Uisnech, is the center of the hill of Uisnech between Mullingar and Athlone, the center point, the navel of Ireland. So it was the point to which all of the energy could come from the different realms, from the above realm, the middle realms, and from the below realms. And they came through, there was a tree, the center tree. You know, Billa means the center, a sacred tree. So every region had its Billa. I think we talked about those before. But the center sacred tree of all the trees in Ireland was Billa Uisnech, the oak tree.
Who decided that? Was this because this particular tree was clearly old and massive?
There's a birth story about that tree, and it's that a magical being called Tre Ulling Tre Ucker, Now, that's just, it sounds like a beautiful word, but when it's hard for us to decipher, but tre ochr, you understand ochr. Ochr is the Irish for key. So the triple key, or the three keys, tre ullingd. Ulling is a word we'd understand in modern Irish. It means fulling, to endure or to suffer, but also to carry a burden. So it's the tre ochr, a tre ulling. The strong burden of the three keys, or the three keys of the tree of the strong burden, or the strong sufferer. Now, what that means, none of us will know, but I think if all of us went for a big walk, or took some mushrooms, or went in meditating, we might each get our own insight of what's trying to be communicated in this magical figure that brought the magical trees to Ireland. Okay, so this man, Tre Ulling, Tre Ochr, it said that he wandered, he came to Ireland, he was coming from where the sun sets in the far, far west. And he was on his way east to where he had heard that a man had been crucified on a Axis Mundi tree, on a sacred cross tree in the east, in Palestine. So obviously, obviously that's just a Christian addition to it. But he arrives in Brú na Boina, which is the most spiritual center of Ireland. And Angus, the great god, is there. And he welcomes, and Angus says, "What are you doing here?" And all of the community are petrified, because this Tre Ulling, Tre Ochr is a giant. He's so big that the entire sky is beneath his legs. Okay? So it's a figure who's so big that the entire sky goes under his legs. And all they're worried about is how they're going to feed him, how the community is going to feed this giant. Because, you know, the whole idea among pre-modern societies is hospitality. If anybody turns up, you need to look after them for at least 3 days. And they think, how could they even feed him for a day? And Tre Ulling, Tre Ochr says, "Don't worry about me. I have this sacred bough in my hand, this sacred branch. And on the branch there was an apple, there was a hazel, and there was an oak, was an acorn." So an acorn, an apple, and a hazel. And he says, "This is all I ever need, and this is all you will ever need." So basically, it's the origin story of the coming of the woodlands to Ireland.
Wow.
And so he could feed himself on the nut, but that hazel that was going to feed him from give him protein, but also was going to give him wisdom. It was the original quill treatment that we talked about, the hazel that that bubbled up through the waters. And I need to still listen back to when you talk about this idea of the bubbling water, you know, in America, the sparkling water, like the idea of our wells, the whole thing. Yeah, the thing that gave him the power was that there was these bubbles of insight bubbling through them. And, you know, as we've realized now, that fishermen off the west coast of Ireland know that there's wells still off the coast of Cork and Kerry that bubble up from beneath the Atlantic Ocean and give them life-giving water. So anyway, this idea of the bubbles is a key thing. So your man, Tre Ulling, has this branch with the fruit of the apple tree that is going to give him sweetness, the protein of the hazel, and also the wisdom of the hazel, and then the acorn that will give all, you know, the reason that the oak was the most important tree was because it gave you the strongest wood for making barrels, for making boats, for making houses, but it also gave you the tanning, its skin, its bark for tanning and for dyes, and it gave you the oak gall, the little round balls that grow on the oak, which are used for ink. So all of the great books the manuscripts were all made with ink from the oak.
So the oak was not only spiritually important, but it's what you just spoke about there when we were speaking about your project with rewilding.
Yeah.
What is the social impact? So the social impact of an oak tree to ancient Irish people was massive. It wasn't just a spiritual tree. This helped people survive and live their lives.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's just pause the conversation right there now, because I'd like to have a little ocarina pause before we continue. I'm in my home studio, so I'm not in the office recording this week. I'm in my studio, so I do actually have my ocarina. So I'm going to play my ocarina here. Now, if you've got a dog, the dog might get startled by this ocarina, but I'm going to play my ocarina and you're going to hear an algorithmically generated advert.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, this is an advertisement for BetterHelp. I have frequently attended therapy for the past 20 years. When I experience anxiety or depression, or when I have difficulty naming and labeling my emotions, identifying my emotions, I often seek the help of a professional therapist to improve my emotional literacy. I've attended therapy in person and I've attended therapy online. If online therapy is something you might be interested in, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, it's convenient, flexible, and it's suited to your schedule. All you gotta do is fill out a brief questionnaire and you get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. So give it a go. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/blindby today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/blindby. Not a very good ocarina. Shit ocarina this week, lads. I haven't played this ocarina in fucking ages. The OG ocarina is lost. I'm down a number of ocarinas, whatever's happening. Someone's coming in and stealing my ocarinas. I had about 10 of them. I'm only left with one. So that was the ocarina pause. You would have heard an advert. I do the pause so you don't get suddenly startled by an advert. But support from this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you enjoy this podcast, if it brings you solace, fun, distraction, entertainment, if you use it to fall asleep, whatever reason you listen to this podcast for, please consider paying me for the work that I do, because this podcast is my full-time job. This is how I earn a living. This is how I pay my rent for my office. It's how I pay all my bills. This podcast is how I operate as a professional artist. This podcast wouldn't be possible without patrons, without it being directly funded by the listener. It simply wouldn't be possible. I wouldn't be able to deliver it each week. So if you enjoy it, please consider paying me the price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month. That's all I'm looking for. Price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month. But if you can't afford that, don't worry about it. You listen for free. Listen for free. Because the person who is paying for you to listen for free. So everybody gets a podcast and I get to earn a living. Wonderful model based on kindness and soundness. My voice is slightly hoarse this week because I've been recording my audiobook. All week I've been recording my audiobook. So my voice is fatigued. Also, directly funding this podcast and any independent podcast, the reason it's important to directly fund the podcast that you enjoy is it means advertisers don't have any creative control. The reason television and radio is awful is because advertisers have control over the content. You can't have that when a podcast is independently funded. I can just tell advertisers to fuck off. I haven't done gigs in a few months. I think my last gig was like March. I've been laying off the gigs so that I could finish writing my book. But I'm back gigging, doing live podcasts. At the end of this month, on the 26th of August, I'm in the Cork Opera House for Cork Podcast Week, the Cork Podcast Festival. come along to that gig. That's going to be wonderful fun, Saturday night fun. Then on the 28th of August, I'm up in Dublin on Vicar Street. Fuck all tickets left for that. Like, literally under 10 tickets left for that. But that'll be an enjoyable gig. But if you can't get tickets for that Vicar Street gig, I am back in November for my official Irish book launch. So come along to that Vicar Street gig. Then, on the 1st of September, I'm over in Birmingham at the Mosley Folk Festival, if you're around for that. What else have I got here? Dunleary is sold out. I'm in Monaghan on the 30th of September, up at the Patrick Kavanagh Festival, the Kavanagh Weekend. And then, and these aren't on sale yet, but I'm going to tell you, I've got a UK tour in November to launch my book. I cannot wait to do this. Now, these tickets aren't on sale yet. They won't go on sale for another week, I believe. I think it's the 16th of August. But I'm going to tell you where I'm going to be gigging in the UK in November for my UK tour, right? And I won't tell you the dates, but it is in November. London, Liverpool, Manchester, Coventry. Fucking promoter has me sounding like the Luftwaffe. London, Manchester, Liverpool, Coventry, and then up in Scotland I'm doing Edinburgh. Alright, so that's where I'm going to be gigging. I didn't gig those places the last time I toured. I want to gig some new places, especially Edinburgh. Usually when I gig Scotland, I gig Glasgow. I haven't been to Edinburgh in years, probably a decade. I don't think I've done a solo Blind Boy show in Edinburgh yet, so I can't wait to come to Edinburgh in November. And the rest of ye, look, Glasgow, who's missing there? I'm not going to Wales this time. A few places missing. I'll be back. All right. London, Manchester, Coventry, Liverpool, Edinburgh. That's what I'm doing in November, and I can't wait to do a podcast for the wonderful Cracking Tans. All right. Then Belfast on the 18th of November. You know the crack. All right. I'm doing all this because my book Topographia Hibernica, my new collection of short stories that I've been writing for the past 2 fucking years that I can't wait to show you, that's coming out in November. So I'm doing this tour, which is half podcast tour, half book tour. So back to the chat with Mancon. And the second part of this is utterly fascinating because Mancon speaks about the time that he spent in Australia recently, learning about the indigenous mythology and folklore there. He travelled there as a folklorist and he was invited by indigenous people to share stories and knowledge with them. Something I do want to flag is I am conscious that it's me and Mancon. Neither of us are indigenous Australian people and we're both speaking about indigenous Australian mythology. Mancon is someone who handles this with respect. And he communicates knowledge that he has learned from spending time with Aboriginal people. But also I carry in my awareness that, you know, we got to be careful. You got to be, if you're not from another Indigenous culture, you got to be careful when speaking about their mythology and their customs and their beliefs. Because even when you have the best intentions, you can be colonial without even knowing it. The last time I toured Australia, which was before the fucking pandemic, just before the pandemic, I did speak to Indigenous Australian people there and recorded podcasts. But then what happened? Big silly fucking idiot. I put my recorder in my luggage and whatever happened on the flight, it zapped the hard drive. So I lost a load of fucking interviews from 2019. But when I do go back to Australia, don't know when that will be, hopefully next year, I will be speaking to some Indigenous people about mythology and culture. But I'm saying this in case any Indigenous Australian people are listening. It is in my awareness that myself and Mancon are not Indigenous Australian people, even though we're speaking about your mythology. And I hope we do it justice and that we're respectful.
And it's great. This is great. Neil McQuitter of the book, who wrote the book Irish Trees, he had the idea, you look at America and or Native Indians in America, First Nations people, the buffalo was their sacred animal and their most practical animal. And mm-hmm. it was it was sacred because it was practical, and it was practical because it was sacred. It was the native people could make everything from the buffalo, from the horns, the skin, the milk, the meat, in the same way as we could make everything from the oak. So it was our most practical and our most sacred.
This is where I'm getting at with my little theory that I believe mythology exists to keep humans in line with system of biodiversities. So if you have an oak tree and you have lots of stories about it and it's very, very important, then within those stories is a great respect. And when you have a great respect for an oak forest, you don't exploit it. You work with it regeneratively.
Yeah, no, without doubt. Another one of the sites that I look at in this new book is Loch Derrina Dyfadia in County Cork. Now, Loch Derrina Dyfadia just looks like a ridiculous name. And I don't even know how local people in it. Sort of beyond Glengariff up in the mountains, you have this place. But you translate that into Irish and immediately it becomes very clear to me. Loch Dodin an Dá Bhó Déag. So Loch the lake, Dodin, dear, it's that word oak again, of the little oak tree or the little oak wood, an Dá Bhó Déag of the 12 cows. And so you think, okay, so here we have the two central ideas of spirituality in Ireland, really, the cow and the oak wood in the same place name. And there's a story attached to it that there was this magical cow who appeared out of this lake once to look after a woman in absolute need. So there was a woman whose husband had died and she had a rake of children and they were starving and she was in absolute penury and no one could help them. And the community were really worried about them. And suddenly this magical cow emerges out of the lake. And not only does the cow give her, the woman and her family, endless milk, strong, life-giving milk, nutritious, rich, creamy milk, but the cow also gives 11 calves. And each of those calves is just as nutritious. And their dung feeds the soil. So this family are suddenly gone from being dirt poor to being incredibly rich, incredibly wealthy. Their land is fertilized by the cow dung. They have milk, they have enough calves to sell to other families and to use as dowries. Until one day, the mother, the old widow, she hits the cow, she beats the cow. And the cow is so startled by this that she lets out a wail and calls her other 11 calves back to her. And they all go back into the lake and drown themselves in the lake again. And without doubt, it's trying to communicate to people. Nature will give abundantly, will give everything you need. But if you abuse or mistreat nature, she can leave on a spot.
And this is also, you find stories like that too attached with a lot of holy wells. Like if you wash your clothes in a holy well, the well can dry up. Like what I find interesting when I was doing research on wells is their wells are treated as people almost. You can offend a well, you can piss a well off. If you fish from a holy well, I read that will piss the well off. If you bathe in a holy well, if you murder someone in a holy well, that the well will dry up and there's your fresh water gone.
I've just made an 8-part series for TG Cahir about holy wells that I think is going to be broadcast.
Fuck off, really? When's that out?
I don't know. I haven't heard. I thought it was going to be autumn, but I haven't heard any date, so it might be spring now. But as you say,
fair play to TG Cahir, man. They make good shit.
They really do, yeah.
I mean, that's brilliant. To commission a program, here's an 8-part TV series about holy wells in Ireland. I mean, we need that.
Exactly. And I'm just down in West Cork, but they got really excited. They have the most holy wells of anywhere in Ireland, in Cork.
Yeah.
And there's just a lovely new hardback book come out called The Holy Wells of Cork, which is gorgeous. But you know, so there's 3,000 holy wells in Ireland. There is no country in the world that has that amount of trees, and not just per head of people. You know, no country has 3,000 sacred wells. And like
And when you say wells, are you looking at this as well from a geology point of view? Is it like, as a well, effectively, it's a natural spring that brings up minerals. That's what it is from a geologic point of view. Are we unique in having lots of that? Or you mean the fact that you put these are spiritually important portals to the other world?
Exactly. So we've 3,000 sacred wells. We probably had a lot more of them at one point.
But they were filled in aggressively as part of colonization too. The landlords would fill in a well, you know, really do this to offend people.
And you can imagine having us spend months going around the country filming wells. A lot of them you're basically having to, bash back a load of brambles or create a wall that was there. everything is being done to try and forget these walls. Often, as you say, it's a developer wants to control that land. Like there's one in the Airside retail park up in Dublin.
Oh, I'd say if you're a fucking developer, you shit your pants if there's a well there. That's like, you're not building here, buddy. So I'd say they go out of their way to cover them up.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's amazing that so many have been kept alive and that so many are being revived. There's people like, I mean, Cork was particularly amazing. There was a very, very good Facebook group over the last few years and people reviving and refinding new wells and opening them up again. And like, what's that? There's no benefit. There's no financial benefit. Why are people doing that? They're feeling this thing that's rising from below us, this awakening. Mm-hmm. Maybe the mycelium is coming and wanting to communicate and say, let's recreate this. You're not going to get healthy water, woodlands, unless you get healthy water streams.
Oh, wow. I never thought of that. Oh, my God. So if you're rewilding an area, it is actually in your interest to bring back the holy wells, to bring back the natural springs.
Exactly. Because
fuck me.
And, you know, but in the Burren, everything is, you know, the wells were often have these pesh, these serpents in them. So, and the serpent would appear often on a particular day, a saint's day, often at either dawn or night. And that serpent was the energy force that would, you know, come out of the lake and sort of give its force. But like, the serpent would appear from sometimes in one well and sometimes another to show that they were connected, that you could get from one otherworldly place. And there's this geographer who's been doing research in that, in the barn, putting dye into a particular well and seeing where it would come up.
Wow.
And just seeing where they connected, yeah. And so he was doing this for a while. And a few years ago, he put water into a well and he said, okay, next day he'd go and check another well to see how it come up. But it hadn't. It had actually, he was in a B&B, opened up the front windows of B&B, looking out at the harbour in County Clare. And suddenly he saw his green dye right throughout the bay, right throughout the sea. So the water he'd put into a well had gone down into his water system and then gone out to the Atlantic Ocean. And that was the first time we had this concept of why all of these supernatural wells in Ireland, like Cunda's well, are said to be beneath the Atlantic Ocean and how they bubble up their pure water of life. Because, of course, at some point, those wells go out underneath the ground, underneath the limestone that's off the Atlantic Ocean, and then bubble up there. So giving these sources of pure water that the people would have on land, also to fishermen out at sea. So actually, you're not only uniting the rivers and the streams and the water systems with the forest, but actually they go out underneath the Atlantic and then come up through the Atlantic too, that everything is united. And the myths were trying to tell us these stories in stories like Cunda's well, like these supernatural wells that were said to be beneath the Atlantic Ocean, and that, you know, the people who are seeking wisdom would go out and find.
That is amazing. One thing I mean to ask you about, because I actually don't know the answer to this question, like werewolves in Ireland, because wolves is in the title of your new book. Werewolves, do we have mythology around werewolves?
So both mermaids and werewolves we're not very sure about. These could be things that came in with the Normans. Like these were, mermaids and werewolves were big things in mainland Europe. And you could understand why in Europe, particularly like stories coming across from Germany and from Poland, where they really were, you know, massive packs of wolves were a big problem, and then in particular murderous wolves. I mean, clearly we know we had wolves in Ireland, but not that idea of these.
And
big...
in the Nordic as well, they had a lot of seals and those mad creatures in the sea, you know?
Exactly, yeah. And both are very, well, particularly mermaids are a really romantic concept. And so anything that's very romantic, it tends to be, you know, the Romance languages. Europe, mainland, like the Latin and the French were big into these love stories and everything and romantic ideas. Whereas Irish, our stories tended to be, they're more real or more gruesome or more...
Well, I think that's the weather. I just think you're going to do more riding in ancient Greece.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, in Ireland, it's wet and grey and cold all the time. Whereas in ancient Greece, it's just like, yeah, fuck it. What else are we going to do? Jesus, Irish mythology isn't very sexy compared to the mythology of other worlds. And if it's a sunny, bright place, I think just people want to ride more for crack.
The other thing is, though, we don't really know our mythology anymore.
Oh, there's the other thing. Yeah, you're dead right. Purified by the 19th century church, actually. Yeah, you're dead right there.
And so it's only in the next 10 or 20 years, those scholars are going to go in and give us a total different sense of what our stories were actually saying.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what's going to happen in 10, 20 years?
All the information is there. All the texts have, well, as you say, okay, some of them would have been cleansed by the church. But really, we have an enormous body of manuscripts, of early texts that that were translated with a particular mindset, just to show that either that it was all about strong men, you know, particularly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when there was an agenda, we were taking back our myths to create a war of independence. And it was brilliant that we picked Cú Chulainn and we picked Finn McCool and these warriors who were willing to sacrifice themselves, because that's what
Patrick Pearse,
the O'Reilly and all want. Yeah, they wanted those. But there's a whole new, particularly, you know, women are going to, like, you look back in the stories, even us with our, you know, you or me with our very limited knowledge, we look at the Tuathail Na Cuailnge and we think, actually, there's a powerful woman behind every one of those men. In fact, the women are setting the whole scene. The men are just these like chess pieces on a board, and the women are actually setting the whole thing. So we might be going back and seeing this. And like, you know, and the key thing about Queen Maeve and the Tuathail Na Cuailnge is no one could do anything. There was no king could be in the country without first having going into her bed and sleeping with her and her deciding that he was up sexually.
Holy fuck. I didn't know that at all.
Yeah. And so none of this was overly emphasized. And there's a new, you know, generation of scholars, hopefully now younger scholars, women and men, are going to go in and actually re-find the actual, the resonances and truth and other underlying currents in our stories.
And I'm assuming that's happening in like UCC, the early medieval Irish literature department and stuff like that. People who can open these texts and read old Irish.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And something that really excited me was, you know, the only person who retold our stories recently was in 1994, Mary Heaney, in other words, Seamus Heaney's wife, came out with a book, Over Nine Waves. It was the first retelling of the myths in decades. And it was a beautifully clean, it was almost as if the New Yorker had rewritten the stories. And they're beautifully told, very clean. And so she had done us a big service. And so I have this, The Almanac of Ireland, my podcast, and I have an interview with her, I don't know, so next few months. But she had done this big service, and, you know, then there was this other woman who I've always heard about and never met until about 3 weeks ago, called Marion Dean. And Marion Dean was going through the old stories, like the birth pangs of Cú Chulainn. So there's a story of Cunachor, the king, was riding out with his huntsmen, and he saw that there was this flock of magical wild birds that were eating every single item around them. They were basically grazing the kingdom dry like locusts, and there were magical birds, and they were chained with golden chains, or it's golden silver chains between them all. So the king sets his greatest hunters, and they try and chase down these wild geese or wild ducks that are eating away everything. But what that seems, that it's a poetic way of talking about winter. You know, there was a darkness is coming across the land, and everything is dying, and everything is being eaten back to the bare earth. Okay, so these gold and silver birds are winter. Cú Chulainn goes up, follows them, gets lost, and arrives in a magical house. And it's said the magical house has this person called Dochtir in it. And anyway, it's the birth story of Setanta, of Cú Chulainn. But Marion Dean, she's the first person to realize, no, this isn't just a farcical story about geese. It's the coming of winter. It's another nature story that you're talking about. You know, this is trying to give information about how to live in a sustainable, respectful way with nature. And the woman in the house, Jachtira, Marion Dean's the first person to say, what does Jachtira mean? Tir, you know, means land. And Jah is good. It's good land. She's basically the Mother Earth. She's the Mother Earth. Cunachor comes in and few people try to sleep with her, don't manage to have a healthy baby. And then when a farmer who is connected to the gods and connected to the spiritual world and honoring nature, when he sleeps with her, Cú Chulainn is born. So I got so excited by this Marion Dean, because I just thought the first person who's going back to the stories and realizing they're not just for kids, they have wisdom in them. And then I realized Marion Dean is the wife of Seamus Dean. So the two, the great poets in Ireland who set up Field Day, you know, the center of poetry and literature in Northern Ireland against, this is in Derry during the Troubles, Seamus Heaney, Seamus Dean and Brian Friel. And now the wives of two of them, of Seamus Dean and Seamus Heaney, are actually doing the key work on decoding and demystifying the Irish mystery, the Irish sort of mythology. And hopefully they are the first generation. I mean, Marion Dean is now in her 80s. So, but my hope is they're going to spark this new younger generation. And from now on in, we will get a whole deeper sense of our myths, of how, just as you're saying, how they're connected with nature, how they were trying to tell people to live in a way that was not only sustainable and in honoring of nature, but in honor of the spirits too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping the future is bright.
And like I said, my big thing with this is to bring this shit back so that people have a respect for the land, a respect and a fear, and to do it in a way that's modern. And like, I don't mean let's bring it back so that people are superstitious again or believing in pishogues, but to understand the mythology of the land and how it relates to biodiversity, and that these aren't just stories, that this is these are the stories of this particular land, and you must listen to them. Like, I did a podcast recently about Yellowstone National Park. You know about it in Yellowstone where they brought the wolves back, yeah?
Yeah, I do. And the rivers changed the course of the rivers.
Mm. Yeah. So I did this podcast and I told people in Yellowstone, the land was fucked. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't know why it was like this. Species were dying off. So they brought back wolves, and then the wolves changed the behavior of the deer, and then the deer stopped spending too much time around the riverbeds and destroying the roots of trees. And just by bringing the wolf back, they transformed an ecosystem. And then what I did is I looked at the mythology of the indigenous people local to that area, and they were the Crow Nation. Mm. And if you look at the fucking mythology of the Crow Nation, who's the most important animal? The fucking wolf.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. They had it. The Crow Nation knew it. Their most important animal was the wolf within the Crow Nation's origin mythology. The wolf creates everything. And that could be thousands of years old. And then scientists in the 90s go, oh, let's bring back the wolf with modern science. And then the Crow Nation are going, told you so.
Beautiful. You know,
and it is fucking beautiful. And you see it everywhere. And I tell you one thing as well that got me thinking about this. It's something that you said to me in a podcast that we did. Is you said that mythology is the fruiting body of the human unconscious.
Mm.
And I keep viewing that as the mushrooms and the mycelium. And when people take magic, like a lot of mythology, I reckon, does come from people doing mushrooms. And when you have when you have any experience, even meditation, and I know this from my own personal experience, what people always report back is, I got a sense that everything's connected. Whether you meditate heavily, whether you do ayahuasca, whether it's mushrooms, LSD, people come back and say, something told me every single thing is connected.
Yeah.
You know, and even when you're talking about the oak tree there and how the druids spoke about the oak tree and, you know, the roots were connected with the other world, and then you have the trunk in this world, and then you have the leaves up in the heavens. I couldn't stop thinking about Sigmund Freud's model of the human unconscious. That's the model of the human unconscious. The roots that are underneath, that's the dream world. That's everything we don't know. Then the trunk in the middle, that's our pre-conscious. That's what we can recollect right now. And then the top, the trees, that's our conscious mind. That's what we're thinking about right now. But it's still that same model of everything there underneath the surface. And then you bring in Carl Jung, who was a huge respecter of mythology. You know, Jung was all about the unconscious. That's the collective human unconscious. That we all share an unconscious mind. All human creatures share an unconscious mind. And this is why mythology all around the world is quite similar.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that we took Freud on closer to us, because it was a more easier to understand package. But
way rational. Like, yeah, Freud is rational and you add it with science, whereas Jung is seen as, shut the fuck up, Carl Jung, you lunatic.
So yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, Jung is going to have Jung will have resonances that we will grow. Our minds will grow to try and understand what Jungian I thought was trying to communicate.
I think quantum physics is what's going to bring it. The discoveries that are happening with quantum physics at the moment, and in particular like quantum weirdness and stuff that's really, really strange, I think that's going to make Carl Jung's work seem less mental. When he speaks about things like synchronicity and meaningful coincidences and things like that.
Like when you were talking about the Crow Nation then, it just brought me everything you're talking about now. So last time we were on, I was talking a bit about the connections I had with these Cree elders, these Native American groups in Edmonton, Alberta, and how they were making me see the world in an entirely different way. And they were they were reaching out because they said, you in Ireland have the same mythology as us, that everything mm-hmm. is connected. You need to go into deep, you need to go into deeper understanding of it. And you need to, yes, of course, follow what I'm talking about, follow the scholars, what they're doing. But actually, you need to go out into the land and either breathe or meditate or take mushrooms and find that wisdom. But then since we've been talking, I've like had an even more profound experience by going to spend time with Native women, sorry, but Aboriginal elders in
Australia.
I
wanted to ask you about this. You've spent time in Australia recently, and I'm mad to hear what happened.
Yeah. Like almost everything we have talked about so far, in other words, about the holy wells or the water under the sea, or the tree, under the land, and the importance of trees, the Aboriginal elders were telling me the same things in their culture. So there's a thing called the Irish Aboriginal Festival that happens every maybe 2 years in Fremantle, just north of, or just outside Perth.
I've been there, and, yeah, it's a lovely place.
Oh yeah, yeah. And it's run by, it's called Kidogo Hand in Hand Festival, run by this woman, Joanne Robertson. And she's been working, she's had an art gallery, so she's been working in Aboriginal artists for 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And she decided she could see all of these connections mythologically and culturally between Irish people and Aboriginal people from way, way back. But also, this, you know, in the even the last 200 years, the interconnections, both positive and negative, that the Irish and Aboriginals set up. So she wanted to have this event, this event to sort of to recognize that. Now, in some ways, you could say there can be no connection between Irish and Aboriginals, because Irish and Aboriginal culture goes back 65,000 years of continuous stories, continuous culture. Where Ireland,
quite,
you know,
isolated, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so Ireland, you know what? I mean, we're the Bronze Age people. Where our culture goes back 4,500 years. Neolithic going back 6,500 years. So the first hunter-gatherers who came here were 10,000 years ago. So, but I go out to Australia last March and I wake up, you know, get a whatever, an Emirates flight out, wake up next morning and Joanna's, I'm in her house and she says, Amankan, there's an elder on the veranda waiting to speak to you. And so Dr. Noel Nanop, one of the key elders of the Noongar nation, of the Noongar Bujar, of this play, of this the traditional placeholders, people of Perth and Fremantle, is there. And he just wants to tell me things. He had heard I was coming to Ireland and to Australia, and he wanted to give me an insight. And so he says, we're looking out over the bay. And he says, look out there. He says, there are three estuaries out underneath the ocean there. And he says, I know that because my people who are here 40,000 years ago, when it was still land, remembered it.
Oh my good fucking God.
And again, only in the last 10, 15 years have the geological departments of the local universities gone out, done underwater surveying, and realized exactly what the Aboriginals people were saying was true, was there. And then he took me to a river, and he started talking about the waggle. And the waggle is the river serpent that carved out the river. And it went the whole way down to Badandi, to Wadandi region, to the sea and salt people down in Margaret's River, right, whatever, 3 hours south of Perth. So Dr. Noel Nanop put me in touch with Dr. Wayne Webb and his son Zach Webb. Again, other cultural lore keepers, elders of the people of this slightly different, again, in Noongar language, but down in Wadandi country. They started talking about the same waga, the serpent. And they were telling me these stories. A serpent carved out the river and then fought with the sea serpent. I knew these stories because we have the exact same stories in Ireland. In fact, even this new book I'm writing, we talk about the Cuéanach. Cuéanach is the serpent of Lough Derg, who carved out the rivers that carved out first the lake and then created this magical hole into the other world and then carved out the rivers. But there's a main story about the Shannon. The Shannon was created by this Ulfaisht. Again, Ulfaisht means great serpent, who carves out the river of the Shannon, gets to Loch Ree, meets some other beasts there, and fights so much that they carve out the whole of Loch Ree, and then goes down eventually to the sea in the Shannon estuary in County Clare. The exact same story told thousands of miles apart. And then they start telling me...
That's fucking nuts, because like there is no way that Indigenous Australian people and Indigenous Irish people had any physical connection. It's too far apart.
Yeah, yeah. So how is it happening? How is Dr. Zach Webb tells me about Cuernup. Cuernup is where the ocean meets the sky, and it's where the spirits go to rest in between lives. Now, Tiernan Og is often said to be at the end of Mog Mel. Mog Mel means Mog is a plain, mill of honey, the plain of honey. It's basically that golden strip of sea where the sun sets, you know, in the west, and there is this roadway, this trackway of golden light of the setting sun. And that was the road to Tír na n-Óg, Mog Mell. It's basically the honey strip. The honey strip that leads to Tír na n-Óg. So we have Tír na n-Óg in some stories being on the horizon beyond where the sun sets. And here in Wadandi country in the south west of Western Australia, they have the Carnup, the exact same concept. And every day, at first I couldn't believe it that these elders were reaching out to me and journeying to come and see me. And I am nobody. I'm a journalist. I'm not a scholar in anything.
They probably have more respect for you than academics, Mancon, because the thing with academics is their academics tend to be very tied to their universities and they're scared to talk and they're scared to be creative. And that's no disrespect to academics, but they tend to be, that's too mad, my reputation is on the line. Whereas you're a lay person with a passion, so you're a lot more open.
Yeah, you and I can get away with things. Because as you say, you and I both know amazing people in academia, but they wouldn't dare write about some of the things that they'll talk to you about.
No. Just because I'm even talking about mushrooms. You know, the shit you're saying there about magic mushrooms, they're just not going to go there because they will privately.
They will.
When you're having a coffee with them.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, I can't put my reputation and my university on the line for this type of carry on, you know?
Yeah, because there are people ready to bring them down. There's only a certain amount of tenure in universities, and it's easy if you put yourself too far above the parapet. Isn't it? They say medicine advances only with the death of every great old professor. Once an old professor dies, then there's room. Just like in a forest, you know? The woodland survived once one of these great old trees fall down. And then they've provided enough nourishment in the soil, in the academia as well, for these new ones to flourish. Mm-hmm. But as you say, so like, what was interesting was every day, like I've made TV programs about South America, about India, about Africa, about all over the world, but I had no idea that there was continuous culture that goes back 65,000 years anywhere on the world, let alone in Australia. It's the only thing
just
we talk.
A quick question there, Mancon, right? Were these people who had writing or was this transmitted via oral culture?
It was oral culture. It was oral culture. It was in stories, and the elders, the lore keepers, were able to keep this information alive. So there was no writing. And in fact, only in the last 6 months there's been new archaeological finds that are showing potential that the culture goes back 120,000 years. That's very preliminary, for the moment. It's just one site.
Just one other thing I'd like you to ask you about as well, Mancon, because you spoke about this on about 3 podcasts ago with me, but I want to know if you encountered it this time. And it's something that to me is so alien, I have difficulty getting my head around it. But as I understand it, don't Indigenous Australian people, have they got a way of walking the landscape whereby the very act of walking the landscape that somehow they can retain knowledge using that way of walking, or that they're able to retain stories, massive stories, through a way of walking?
Exactly, yeah. And as you said, I've talked about that to you and I've written about it, and I had no understanding of the profundity of it until I went out there.
I mean, my head is too Western. My head is too fucking Western to get that.
I know, but Blind Boy, if you went out there, if you saw the things and if you experienced the things I've experienced, first, they're called the song lines, you know?
Yeah.
And they are this way of encoding information about everything, mainly about how the landscape, the information that you need about the landscape if you're traveling across it. In other words, where the water holes are. Like, it was so interesting. Me talking to them about our sacred wells and them talking about their water holes and how sacred the water holes are. And so much of Aboriginal art, it's about symbols showing you where the water holes are. And of course, the first thing...
And I get them, water holes are a bit more important in Australia than they are in Ireland, I'd imagine, like for survival.
Exactly, exactly. So the first thing that the colonizers did often, they polluted the water holes.
Fucking gowls.
Yeah, exactly.
For the crack or just out of ignorance?
No, for the crack, to know how do we kill off a people, just pollute the water holes.
In the same way
as this, there's this great American academic on Irish Holy Wells. She has a book coming out this year called Dr. Celeste Ray. She's over in America. But she's realizing, do you know the way any river, we were so proud of our water mills in Ireland. So there's either there'll be flax mill or flour mill or anything else. A lot of those were an attempt to basically pollute and industrialize the sacred wells. Our river source, our wells were the sacred. So yeah, put in a fucking industrial plant, basically put in Intel beside, the Liffey, put in a water mill or a paper mill was always a polluting thing. So sometimes it was just it happened. The water source was there, and they used that as to use that as a power source for industrialization of products. But also there was an idea, let's take away the sacredness of this well or this water source by putting...
Let's rationalize the river. I mean, that's what you're doing. Let's rationalize this. What does that river do? It spins a fucking big cog, and that's where bread comes from.
That's exactly.
And it's owned by somebody. This is capital.
Just like we've dammed all of the sacred rivers in Ireland, all of the rivers that were the goddesses in water form, in physical form, put a dam on it, stop the energy going through. And with all those plans to take the Shannon, take all the water of the Shannon and bring it up to Dublin, just strip the power from it. But anyway, so the Songlines, as you say, is the lore of local place that was encoded into these songs that were sung as the people moved across the land. And not only does it tell about where the water holes are, but it tells about geological happenings that would have happened hundreds of thousands of years ago. It tells about different berries and different berries and flowers and roots that are available in whatever season. So the Aboriginals have a different season. They either break it up into six or eight seasons of the year, and then each season would have a different color connected to it, and each color would have a different wind and different plants. So once you know any element of the system, whether either the songs or the food or the seasons, they're all so tied in together that you are entirely looked after. And that is all really encoded in these songs. And I mean, so many of the song lines have died off. But the elders I was meeting, particularly like the role of the art, is so important, Aboriginal art that sells for millions in New York galleries. That's another way of encoding the song lines. So the song lines were sung. They were also encoded in rock art. Like there was no such thing as art on canvas, obviously. It didn't have canvas until we came along. So it was always rock art to give the information. But again, the reason
these weren't just pretty pictures.
No. And the symbols on those pictures are identical to the symbols you find in Newgrange and on rock art in Ireland.
Now, fuck me.
Most likely they had different meanings to those symbols, but maybe they didn't. Because like when we look at all of the lozenges and the scrolls and the coils in the
rock spirals.
Art, the spirals in Irish art, we find it hard to know what they mean. We have to come up with different, ideas of what they might. But Aboriginals know what their rock arts mean, what their symbols mean. So, nobody has done that correlation, comparing the two yet, because no one in Australia yet. There are anthropologists and archaeologists. So archaeologists are looking at the rock art and anthropologists telling the story. In no university in Australia are the anthropologists and the archaeologists in the same department. They're just on purpose, they're dividing them. And the minute you put the rock art and the knowledge that's encoded in the land with the myths, everything opens up. But in the same in Ireland, nobody is really connecting, to a great degree, all of the archaeological evidence in Ireland with the mythological, because we dismissed the mythological. It was all make-believe. It was all useless. So what's going to happen is amazing developments have been done in Ireland in archaeology in the last 20, 30 years, particularly because of the building of the roads and all of the destruction of the ancient sites by the roads, but also the excavation that's led to. But no one has tied that up to see what information from all this masses of information we have about the archaeology of Ireland, what new insights can we get by comparing that with mythology.
Like, I spoke recently to a fella called Anthony Murphy, who he operates up around Newgrange. Yeah. Yeah. And Anthony is, again, he's a lay person. And his whole thing is, he's an astronomer. He loves astronomy. And he correlates astronomy with geography, with ancient tombs, to bring them together. But straight up, he said to me, the academics come to him, the academics from the universities come to him and speak to him, but they could never say what he's saying because it's seen as too mad. He's mixing too many different genres together to come to answers.
Yeah, exactly. And luckily, so that first elder I met in Australia, Dr. Noel Nanop, he is considered to be the prime expert on the stars, on the whole astronomy of Western Australia, and even the main planetarium will have him in maybe once a month or a few times a month to give the talk. So the astronomer will give their official limited view, and then in comes Dr. Noel Nanop, who will talk about the star. What's unique about the way that Aboriginal people saw the nighttime star sky was that, we look at it from star to star, and we make patterns from those stars. They look at the space in between. So they look at what's not there. So we're looking at the white lights, they're looking at the black. And when they see the black in their view of the Milky Way, they see emu, they see dark emu. Basically this big black shape that looks for all like a dark emu when you see it. And it's just, it's the reverse way. It's basically looking at what is not there, than what's there. And really, that's what I had to get used to. So, I mean, I had a few enough insights in this Irish Aboriginal Festival, but when I went up north, up to the Kimberley and up to the Great Sandy Desert and the Tanara Desert, that's when my mind was blown up. Because before I went, you know, a lot of these places, there's no roads. It's just sand. I had to get, me and Joanna had to rent a really good Land Rover with sand mats, with extra diesel tanks, with a satellite phone, with anti-snake venom, and just go up into the wilderness where we had been invited by elders who, some of these communities, they never allow white people in. You know, there'll be a few government teachers and all, but otherwise there's a big sign, you're only allowed into this community is if you've been well, if we have invited you, you know, and stop at the place. But this is where these communities are, where they're keeping the information live. So if you go down, if your only experience is meeting an Aboriginal person in a city, they're the ones who've already been forced into a city for some reason. They came down because they were sick, they needed a job, they have something. And the minute an Aboriginal person is off country, is not connected with the land anymore, the power is gone from them, the life force is gone.
Is this the belief system of the Indigenous people? Is this what they would say about themselves?
That's what they would say about themselves. But you see it. Like, there was one point I was in, we went to Balgo, and Balgo was an old former mission that was brought, set up by missionaries to try and, you know, bring in the Indigenous people from the Aboriginals from the wilds of the Great Sandy Desert.
It's worth noting as well to say to people, legally in Australia, Indigenous Aboriginal people, in the eyes of the government, were considered animals up until the 1970s.
Exactly. Yeah, they were under the Department of Fisheries and Nature. Yeah,
which
exactly.
is just fucking disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
But there you have it.
But yet, you know, something key is happening in November of this year. In November of this year, there is going to be a vote, a referendum in Australia about the voice, whether to give Aboriginal people the voice in Parliament for the first time. And it's a key moment. You can imagine. It is in no way guaranteed that this is going to go through in Australia. And Ireland, we have an enormous role to play. Like, we have every family in Ireland has relations in Australia.
Of course.
And we have this almost obligation, this duty to now become aware of Aboriginal issues between now and autumn. I don't think the date has been fixed yet.
But also healing, because the Irish Catholic Church did a lot of damage to Indigenous Australian people.
They really did. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we were involved with massacres too, where these are, let's say we came out with a sad story. We came out on, you know, as criminals, victims of Britain. But when we eventually were freed from prison, men, you know, would set up a homestead somewhere. And if there were Aboriginals there, there was massacres. They'd wipe them out and bury them in holes. And Irish were involved with that too. So there's a dark legacy. And still today, like, you know, Perth is beautiful, as you saw, and Fremantle is beautiful, but every person you and I saw, you did a gig there, you did, yeah. And I did shows there, and I was invited out. We were all under the pocket of the mining company, you know? Every ticket, you know, 80% of the tickets that you were, of the people who bought tickets to you, were being paid directly or indirectly through the mining company. Like every coffee shop, every restaurant, they're only there, Western Australia.
It's a company town.
It's a company town, exactly. And they're all, this idea, you know, isn't it fly in, fly out? They're all on these small short-term contracts. They go into Fremantle and Perth to let their hair down for a weekend or something, or a week off, 3 weeks off, and then they're shipped back up. They're flown back up north again to these mining places. So if my first 2 days in Australia were just these elders coming to meet me and to try and tell me their way of talking, seeing the world, prepare me particularly for what was going to happen up north, and to do ceremony on me, because it was going to be spirits up in the north that they say I wouldn't be able to deal with on my own. I need their protection.
When you went into the their area, the Indigenous, the outback.
Exactly, the outback. Yeah. They wanted to prepare. But then, so that was the first 2 days. And then day three of this Irish Aboriginal Festival, which happens around St. Patrick's Day, where the Irish people were there, because it was a Sunday, so they were off work, okay? And the stories I was hearing, there was one that I was meeting, it was mainly the cultural people. So the people who were out of UCC or UC or NUIG haven't done anthropology, archaeology. Okay. So the mining companies are now having to hire huge amounts of Irish archaeologist students to go out and to be the forerunners. And there's now a rule, you know, there was this terrible, the Dukan Gorge, there was a terrible destruction done by Rio Tinto of a gorge, many thousand-year-old sacred gorge a few years ago in Australia. And ever since then, they have to do archaeological and anthropological research before they go in and mine anywhere. Okay? So they need loads of young archaeologists and anthropologists. And I was meeting these people, a young bloke from Roscommon, and he said, like, he had been out, he had brought the elders of a particular community out to see where the local mining company was. And, you know, when I'm talking about mining, it's everything. It's from copper, it's iron, it's lithium, it's emeralds, it's diamonds, everything is out there.
This is why Australia is rich, like, yeah.
Exactly.
The natural resources there is mad.
That's right. So there's this one Roscommon lad, anyway, he had been out to bring these elders out to see where their next area of the mining was going to be a few weeks or a few months before. And then just about 5 days before I met him, he had brought these same elders out in a lovely white air-conditioned ute out along the track to see the post-mining landscape. And post-mining landscape, everything was gone. All of the sacred rock art, all of the sacred sites, these ritual places had been destroyed. And so the elder broke into tears and said, stop, stop the car, I can't go on. But the elder had brought three other members of his community to support him. They pulled over and they said, you have to go on. You are the eyes of our community. We have somehow, this has been destroyed on our watch. We are the gatekeepers of our sacred lands that have been kept alive for whatever, 40, 50, 60,000 years. We need to see, we need to report it back. And so this bright young 24-year-old Roscommon man, who was on way more money than he could ever have in his life before, was utterly shook when he told me. He was white. Basically, he had witnessed, he had been involved in the destruction of the sacred landscape of people. And that's what they did. Another woman told me she had just helped, you know, build a new road into an area. You build a new road into an area, you get tourists coming in, you get all the sacred art slowly gets either taken away and stolen and brought back to the cities.
But here's the thing, Mancon. If an indigenous elder says, you can't build there, Mr. Mining Company, will he actually be listened to?
So they have a thing called is native titles. So they do control their own lands. And so, in one way, they have control. But all the mining company needs to do is go to another elder. These are communities that don't have strength anymore. Alcoholism, drug abuse is so rife. And people are absolute desperate.
I'd say there's real dirty shit going on. I'd say that, like, corporations are not nice people. And when corporations want something done, they will find a way to do it illegally.
Nothing stops it. Like, it's so easy to pick off the elders. You know, so many of them have such severe health problems that, they're either desperate for money, they need to get somewhere, or they have a child. And, like, the tragedy.
So they've been marginalized. Marginalized in a way that their backs are against the wall.
Beyond marginalized, yeah. Like, so I went into some very, very dark and just communities that were in real, real despair. But I went into only one. This is the one that says, we do not allow white people in. You know, you had to have a permission. This was Yili between Fitzroy Crossing and Hall's Creek up in the Kimberley, up on the way towards the Pilbara. And I went into this community and it was first signs. I was hopeful. I thought these people are pretty healthy and they're an amazing school system and trying to get good food and trying to get education. Still in that place that everybody is looking out for each other and everyone's got each other's back, you still see this, a white ute will turn up, a pickup will turn up of a mining company. And they're all kind of, you know, they're spread out communities. So this white ute will turn up and it'll be one man with a form and with a pen and trying to get one elder to sign. And all he needs to do is get one elder to sign in this incredibly healthy community, where alcohol is banned, where people are generally in good health. But if they can get in that easily to a place like that, you know, there's not, they've in the places where, like in Hall's Creek, we were sort of advised not to go to Hall's Creek because there were, every night, the Aboriginals come out with spears and were spearing each other with fighting just because things had broken down so much. But on a Friday night in Hall's Creek, the mining companies come with their royalty checks. So all of these elders have a native title. They're entitled to this land, so the mining companies have to pay them royalty. On a Friday, you'll get, you know, maybe a diamond, a copper, titanium, lithium, whatever, as miners will come. They'll drop 30 grand in that town, and they paid them just outside the pub, the one pub. So the pub will get 30 grand that weekend. All the money goes directly through there. And then if any of the mining company wants signatures, they're just there on Monday or Tuesday morning where, you know, they've lost all their money again. The solution for the oldest continuous culture in the world can't be within Australia. because everyone I met, including me, including you, we benefited from that when we went there. My flights were paid for that. My tickets, everything was indirectly or directly through mine. All the universities I visited, they're all being sponsored by the mining companies. So the only chance is if the world says, wait there, there's only one culture in the world that has a continuous culture of 65,000 years, still alive with all of this knowledge. We all need to work and pay the price to protect Aboriginal culture. And so that's why the voice is a key element. And that's why, like, since coming home, I've now committed myself. I'm writing a book about the links between Irish and Aboriginal culture. I'm going to make a TV series about links between Irish and Aboriginal culture. And I'm going to try and get one of those big international, the big collections of Aboriginal art that were done in Sydney, curated exhibitions that sometimes tour outside to London or San Francisco or to LA or somewhere. I'm going to try and get one of those to Ireland too. Because only once we see the art can we then begin the process of understanding the song lines. And once you understand the song lines, these stories and songs that encode all of the wisdom both in of this realm and the realms beyond for the people, do you get a sense of, wow, the wisdom and the wealth and their connection with spirit. And the magical things, I was told if I went up north, I would encounter the spirits. Magical things would happen. Things that I could never again explain to anyone would happen. And like, without doubt, they did, without doubt. One reason that we got up to this place that you never, you know, get access to is because Kemet Dawson, who is the Gooniyandi loreman of this community of Yili, Gooniyandi is a particular small group of people who manage to keep their knowledge alive. And for him, his totem animal is the white owl, because his great grandfather was the white owl. And he knew his great-grandfather. And so the totem that his great-grandfather left him was the white owl. And so the one time that Kenneth Dawson came down to my friend Joanne Roberts, who has this Kidogo art house in on the beach there, in Bader's Beach in Fremantle, which is where the Irish Aboriginal Festival happens. The one time Kenneth Dawson came down, they looked up in the trees above and they saw a white owl. And no one had ever seen a white owl in Fremantle before. They're just not there. And Kenneth says, oh, no, that's my great-grandfather. He follows me when I'm on spiritual business. So
fucking hell.
Joanna just said, okay, just didn't know it. And anyway, Joanna and I, we fly up 3.5 hours up to Kununaru, hire this Jeep, you know, it costs us a fortune with the sand mats and the satellite phone and the snake bite venom. Go drive for hours and hours across the desert to get to Balgo. Then, you know, another, like 20 hours, is like long journeys. Get up to Yili at night. To this, the road that leads into an off-track road that eventually leads you down to the community. And we stop dead straight on the muddy road at night because there's a white owl right in the middle of the mud track. And so we stop just in time. And the white owl, just as we stop, it rises up above our windscreen and over our head. And so we ring Ken Dawson. We say, Ken, we've just been stopped. We were arriving at your place, but a white owl was there. And he said, oh yeah, no, that's okay. That's my great-grandfather. That's you. You're being welcomed on land. You'll be safe.
Wow.
You're welcome to country. So we thought nothing about it. Went down, spent a magical few days hunting with them, telling stories, sharing knowledge, watching their paint, learning the whole time. And as we were leaving again at night, back on that mud road, and there's the white owl right in the middle of it. And so we pull up and the white owl watches us, looks in our eyes, and then goes beyond the hedgerow. The dashboard, and we drive off. We then have like an 8-hour drive on in dark roads to back to Kununaru. And as we're going, the first 5 miles, we encounter 27 white owls on the road, going, flying above us. We're constantly having to start, stop. And everyone I've asked since then, they said, no, that's an impossibility. No one has ever seen 27 white owls. They couldn't have happened. So had Joanna not been there, I would have been sure I'd made up the entire thing. But something profound happened that I'm still having to deal with.
And again, it all ties in with fucking Carl Jung. Like Jung, like what I'm trying to get at is when you say, Jesus, the Aboriginal mythology and Irish mythology is so similar, Carl Jung would say, yeah, that's the human collective unconscious. Also what Carl Jung would say is, when you live your life with an openness to... If when you live your life with an openness to psychic energy like that, to when you live your life with an openness to your dream world, then synchronicity will occur, meaningful coincidences will occur, like that, like the owls.
Yeah.
The psychic energy. Now, like, Young claimed that when him and Freud would argue about this, the books would explode in the fucking... He said the books used to explode in their shelves, you know, and that's when most people go, right, well, I'm not listening to Carl Jung anymore. He's mad. But I get what you're saying there from a Jungian perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Completely, you know?
Like, even every time people had to do rituals with me each time. So when I was in first in Fremantle, they had to tell the spirits I was there and welcome me to the country. And when I went down to Wandandi, another elder did. Then up in the north, in one place, I had Mosquito family, a great woman, did these rituals. And every time they'd do them, they'd say these words, they'd rub, they'd get me to rub the sweat of my body into sand or into stone or into plant, mm-hmm. and then to put that into water. Like, they said to me, okay, once we've done this, once the spirits, we're waiting until the spirits have heard, have seen you, welcomed you, and then the ritual ends. And they said, when it'll happen, let's say when I was by the river, they said, a gust of wind is going to come up the river and you're going to feel it. When I did it down with Zach Webb, there by the tide, the shore, they said, okay, step back now. There's going to be a big wave is going to come up and wash. And that means it's a welcome from the sea that you're welcome in this area. And if you don't get that, they said, we can't allow you on country. We can't allow mm-hmm. you even in the community. And they said, let's say even if you're particularly at night when you're gathered around the fire, if you leave the fire for any reason, you need to tell one of us that you're leaving. We need to ask the spirits or we need to accompany you. And even the only reason I got up to Balgo, like a lot of people won't go near this community in the Great Sandy Desert because of the strength of the spirits. So I had a man telling elders, particularly Helicopter. Helicopter is the last elder. He's the only one of the first contact people I met. So first mm-hmm. contact people, he was the first of his people to ever meet white people. So he mm-hmm. was sickly and his community were out in the desert. They were roaming the desert and they decided, no, he's too sickly. He won't survive. And a CHOP missionary came down with a helicopter and they put him on the helicopter. And so they brought him to Balgo and dropped him there. And he was the very first of his people. A few then of his aunts and uncles came in later, about 10 years later, I think. But he's now, his art is like, so sells for millions in New York. He's, mm-hmm. he's old, but like his knowledge, that idea of, he's seeing a spirit world before he's seeing a physical world.
Look, that's interesting when you tie that back with how they look at the stars. Seeing a spirit world before you see the physical world, and then you look up at the stars and you see the darkness before you look at the stars.
Interesting. Yeah. Seeing the beyond. And we think our ancestors in Ireland saw that. That's why, we know that the Tír na n Og, all these other worlds were just as real to them as this real world. And that, I believe that was right up until the 1930s, because again, you can see it in the school's collection. The older people there in every community in Ireland were able to talk where the magical thresholds were, where the fairy folk or the otherworldly beings came through in their locality.
So that was my chat with the magnificent Mancon Magan. That was tremendous fun. He's such a curious individual. He's so passionate about what he does. He's so passionate in the way that he speaks. And I adore chatting to him. So check out his book, Wolfmen and Waterhounds, which you can pre-order. It's out in September. And check out any of his books or listen to his podcast, The Almanac of Ireland. And I'll catch you next week for a hot take. Don't know what it's going to be about. We'll figure that out in the meantime. And you go. You go and you rub a dog. Genuflect to a swan, blow kisses at a pine marten.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.